The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is your producer, Sam Livingston. I'm normally on the other side of the window here helping Mr. Fleury produce the show. But today I am giving the show, and you know that a lot of events have to line up in order for that to happen. Mr. Fleury has to be traveling. Richard has to be busy. Every other employee has to be out somewhere. Jude would probably have to be at an Irish dance fesh, my wife would have to be out shopping. And if all of those things happen on the same day, you're left with me to give the radio show. So hopefully we'll have a fun and exciting show for you today. Mr. Fleury is still traveling. He is in Jerusalem. Yesterday he recorded his show from Jerusalem, and he had a lot to say about the work going on over there and his father's trip in Australia and the Philippines. He also talked a fair bit about the news coming out of Gaza and the protests going on there. So if you haven't yet listened to that program, I'd encourage you to go back and do so. For today's program, I'd like to talk about a more controversial topic, and I didn't think it would be very controversial at the time until I started reading more and more about it, and I realized how much people dislike Winston Churchill and the Jewish state of Israel. And today I have crafted a program that combines these two subjects, two of my favorite subjects, Churchill and Israel, into one program. I'd like to just read, to start off here, a few articles that have appeared in the news recently about Winston Churchill. This one historian, his name is Richard Langworth. He works at Hillsdale College. He has been collecting a timeline of the anti-Churchill articles that have appeared in the news in recent months. I'll just read through a few of these articles. He says, in April or May of this year, the Oxford Union is planning to debate the motion, "This House believes Britain should be ashamed of Churchill." So the Oxford Union, obviously that's at Oxford College in the UK, and they're going to debate whether or not Britain should be ashamed of Churchill, as if this should be a question. Churchill is often regarded as the greatest Briton. And here we are, I guess it's been over 60 years since his death, and should Britain be ashamed of him? Another article, historian blames Churchill for war crimes in Africa and famine. Another article is titled, "An Unpopular Racist." This one is from a member of parliament in India. Hollywood rewards a mass murderer, talking about the latest Churchill movie and the actor there getting the award for best actor. Here's another article, Winston Churchill, the barbaric monster. And then there are quite a few that talk about his supposed affair with another woman. All of these articles have been proven false by historians. Here's another article, some wonder if he was more of a war criminal. Another one, don't forget his problematic past. And of course, Churchill was not a perfect human being. There's only one perfect human being in man's history. Of course, he had his mistakes. But on the whole, we have to look at the fruits. And this man, without a doubt, saved Western civilization. I find it particularly funny when these Indian authors write about it. They say the British Empire was enslaving the Indians and Churchill was this mass murderer. But this one author, I won't try to pronounce his name, he is a member of India's parliament. And I laughed when I saw that because they talk about Churchill as if he is this, or the British Empire, as if it was enslaving all of these people, when in reality, India is the biggest democracy in the world. And they have a parliament. Where did that come from? Well, that's from Britain. So here's an elected official. working within Britain's system of government, and it has done so much for his country, and talks about all of this as though, well, we need to get rid of it because it was racist and because Churchill was a murderer. Also in the news, you hear a lot about these statues being torn down. You know, the bust of Winston Churchill and I think Cecil Rhodes and in America especially with, I think the recent one was President McKinley. They've taken down a statue of his. So we're ashamed of this history. We're ashamed of these great men in history. And Richard Palmer and I were talking about this a little bit today in my office, and it's really not even worth spending the time to answer a lot of these articles critical of Churchill, because it can be done so quickly. A lot of these statements that they make, if you read the next sentence that they quote from Churchill, they leave that out, it vindicates him. And they just pull these quotes out of context, and it's really not even worth arguing with them about it. But what's alarming is that those views are becoming so popular. And they're pulling down these statues and we're erasing history. And Richard and I were wondering, well, what if these men didn't exist in history? That's a whole nother program that you could go into. What if George Washington didn't exist? You know, because he was so evil and because he was a racist, what if he just never lived? What if Churchill never lived? What if these big evil men never existed? Well, would we have democracy as we know it today? Would we have free speech? Would we have all of these luxuries that we enjoy? The internet, democracy, freedom, so many things that have come from Britain and America and Western civilization. And, you know, we just destroy all of that because we rip some things out of context or we judge them by the moral standards of our day. One thing that I find particularly frustrating, especially as a young person just studying history, is, well, really the audacity of a lot of these young people to dismiss what these great men did. They're establishing countries. They're fighting wars. They're writing these documents that have shaped, you know, the policy of the globe for hundreds of years. And we read one sentence out of context, or we find one story that fits our bias, and we dismiss the entire legacy of that individual. Winston Churchill wrote 50 million words. That's his speeches and books combined. 50 million. And some 24-year-old, 25-year-old comes and finds one quote, one sentence, pulls it out of context, and labels him a racist, and we dismiss all of it. And, you know, just as a young person, I really rely heavily on these books from men like Martin Gilbert and William Manchester, who have laboriously worked to compile thousands and thousands of pages about this man and the detail they go into. It's incredible. But so many people just let their own bias, they let their own revisionist view of history destroy all of that. Well, I'm going to talk about a subject that probably is not going to make those writers like Churchill anymore. It's probably going to make them more hostile to Churchill, but who cares? You know, we have to look at the fruits, and these people are going to attack these figures more and more. But we just have to look at the fruits. We have to look at, you know, what America and Britain have done in the course of history, what the little nation of Israel has done. And I'd like to specifically talk about Churchill's role in establishing the Jewish state of Israel. Now, I thought this would be an easy subject to cover in 1 hour, but there is a ton of material here. In my research, I came across Martin Gilbert's book that is titled Churchill and the Jews, so I'm trying to digest a lot of information here into a one-hour program, and there's so much material here, and it's really a fascinating study when you consider Churchill's role in history in saving Britain in World War I and World War II, when you consider Israel's role in world history. And, you can dismiss a lot of this. Israel is the enemy today in the West, and especially the liberal media are always going after Israel. But there are just a few things to consider here. The fruits of that nation. It's the one democracy in the Middle East. There are 2 million Arabs living in Israel that are Israeli citizens. You know, in Syria, there's a civil war. In Iraq, there's still ISIL and Iran moving in over there. Egypt and still suffering from the Arab Spring. All these countries in this chaotic region. And you just have little tiny Israel there. You know, buried. You can barely see it from a world map. It's just this little fingernail of a country tucked away in there. And you have this bastion of democracy and prosperity. I was really inspired. I was given the opportunity to travel there about a month or two ago. Just an exciting, exciting opportunity. And I was fascinated at how advanced this country was. You know, you think of the Middle East and you're seeing these videos of the Islamic State and, well, it's just a big sandbox, really. But Israel is, they've got these highways, and along the highway from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem is this state-of-the-art railway. And there's all this technology that's going on in here. Well, what, you know, what created this, or where did this start? Well, let's just go ahead and get into it here, talking about Churchill's relationship with the Jews. And Gilbert, this is Martin Gilbert, Churchill's historian. He starts his book, Churchill and the Jews, and this with this statement. This is in his foreword. He says, "For his, Churchill's, support of Zionist enterprise in Palestine, Churchill was warned publicly by one member of parliament that as a result of this effort, he would find himself up against the hereditary antipathy which exists all over the world to the Jewish race. Churchill was not deterred. While never an uncritical supporter of Zionism, he was one of the most persistent friends and advocates. In a world where Jews were often the objects of scorn, dislike, distrust, and hostility, Churchill held them in high esteem and wanted them to have their rightful place in the world. At a time when he was criticizing Jewish terrorist acts against the British in Palestine, he told a Jewish friend who was uneasy about his criticisms, "The Jewish people know well enough that I am their friend." Gilbert says, "This was true. He was both a friend in their hours of need and friend indeed." So Churchill was not afraid to stand alone here. And we know that if you've read anything about him, that he was always going against the grain. He was always having to stand up against his own party and take a view that wasn't popular. And he did this in respect to the Jewish state. As the Jews are being persecuted, he stands up for them. And you think about that at the time. And again, what comes through is Churchill's vision. William Manchester uses the word prophet a lot in his book, The Last Lion. And you take Churchill's stance in the early 1900s of wanting to see a Jewish state, and you think about what Israel is today, what I said just a few minutes ago about them being the leading democracy there, the only democracy, and such a close ally of America and Britain and the West. That wasn't a popular view that Churchill had at the time, not at all. But you look at that vision, you look at his foresight, and he has this ability to see decades and decades into the future, hundreds of years. And why is that? Well, he studied history. And Mr. Gerald Fleury has talked a lot about how much Churchill has looked back into history in order to look into the future. Now, this creation of this Jewish state was really an undercurrent of Churchill's entire career. You don't hear about it as much as you hear about, you know, what he was warning before about Germany before World War I and World War II. But just simmering under there this whole time was the Jews working towards statehood, and Churchill really there as a friend and pushing this through. Going all the way back to Churchill's first year at Harrow Academy, I think he would have been about 12 or 13 when he attended this school, he wrote his first essay was about Palestine in the time of John the Baptist. Now, why this young teen, maybe 12, 13 years old, is writing an article about Palestine in the time of John the Baptist? Well, he's reading the Bible, and he sees the Old Testament, and he sees the Bible as, you know, this is really the seat of Western civilization. This is where we came from. In 1908, Winston Churchill said, this is from the book, The Last Lion, Manchester's book, he quotes Churchill saying, "Jerusalem must be the only ultimate goal. When it will be achieved, it is vain to prophesy. But that it will someday be achieved is one of the few certainties of the future." In 1908, he's looking at Jerusalem and saying, it will be established. It is the ultimate and the only goal. Where does that come from? What's he reading where he is inspired to say something like that about Jerusalem? That's in 1908. And moving on, another 10 years, we get into the Balfour Declaration. And really what you have to keep in mind with this declaration, this really is the start of the Jewish state as far as governments recognizing them. Going into this declaration, you have Jews living in Russia, and they are being persecuted systematically. I think it's in the first, maybe, I think it's about 30 years prior to this declaration, Jews had been persecuted in Russia. I think it's something around 200,000 Jews had been murdered. Jews weren't allowed to live in cities in Russia. So these people are already being persecuted, not in Germany, but in Russia. And Britain is looking at them and thinking, these people have no place to go. And you get to 1917 and the Balfour Declaration, and World War I is winding down. The Ottoman Empire, and which is Turkey, is who owns that area of Palestine where Israel is established, is waning down. They're about to be defeated. And then you get this declaration from Arthur Balfour. This is what William Manchester writes in The Last Lion. "The Balfour Declaration, promulgated in 1917 when Arthur Balfour was the coalition's foreign secretary and Jewish political power was at its zenith in London, had proclaimed that the British government favored the establishment of a national home for the Jewish people." And that's what you have to, that's the language that's important for this, that the British government favored the establishment of a national home for the Jewish people, not their own country, just a Jewish home, "and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of that object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine." So here is Britain's view at the time. This Balfour Declaration says, we will do whatever we can to help create a homeland for the Jewish people. And in context of that, we also don't want to remove the non-Jewish inhabitants there, the Arabs. So they're being very diplomatic about this. They're not planning to go there and uproot any of the Arabs living there. There's plenty of space in Palestine at this time. I think today the population of Israel is something like 7 or 8 million, and at the time there's only about 500,000 people, if that, living in this area, so it can take in a lot more refugees. And at this time, 1917, you get to the year 1918, and Turkey has fallen. The Ottoman Empire collapses. They had control of all of this land beforehand, and control of that land now falls into the hands of Britain. Now, what's important to remember here is that the Arabs took advantage of that immediately. The Arabs had been oppressed by the Turks with the Ottoman Empire, and as soon as they collapsed, the Arab people really went on the warpath. I think the leader of what was this part of Saudi Arabia strolled up to Damascus and took that city. And this is where you see the divvying up of this region. So Saudi Arabia is established as its own country. Possession of Syria and Lebanon goes to France, Britain's ally. and then Britain gets control of Persia, Mesopotamia, and Palestine. So those are the ruling powers here. And what happened here is they created their they created Arab states. They gave the Arabs their own nations. They created Syria and Iraq and Transjordan. They gave the Arabs their own nations, but they didn't give the Jews their own state. The Jews just had a right now to their own homeland. It wasn't a sovereign nation. So by 1920, this is at the end of a few years after the war has concluded and Churchill is getting tired of his post in the War Office. And he tells the Prime Minister that he'd like to move to another cabinet post. This is from Martin Gilbert's book, Israel, A History. This is around the year 1920, and he's quoting Churchill here. "We owe to the Jews a system of ethics, which even if it were entirely separated from the supernatural, would be the most precious possession of mankind, worth, in fact, the fruit of all other wisdom and learning together." This is what Churchill said of the Jewish system of ethics. And what is that? It's the Old Testament. It's the Bible. And he's looking at that. This is the foundation. And he says, even if it weren't for the intervention of the supernatural, this would still be the best thing that we've created. That same year, Churchill wrote to the Prime Minister again, Lloyd George. He wrote, "The Palestine venture is the most difficult to withdraw from, and one which certainly will never yield any profit of a material kind." So in 1920, he's asking to be moved out of the War Office. He's put into the Colonial Office, and here he is. He has this strong view about the Jews in Palestine, and he says, there's no commercial gain here. Britain was spending actually millions trying to maintain this land and keep the peace between the Arabs and the Jews. And Churchill says in 1920, we have nothing to gain here, but we need to do it anyway. And Churchill was put in the position that would give him the most influence over the creation of this state. He's appointed as colonial secretary a year later. And from there, he was responsible for organizing the chaos in the Middle East. And along with that, he had to deal with Ireland, which probably took more of his time than anything. Manchester writes in the last line, "Nevertheless, by the time he entered the colonial office, he was committed to it. The more he pondered the issue, the more his enthusiasm for a Jewish homeland grew, and he reaffirmed the declaration, that's the Balfour Declaration, at a time when a majority of the British officials in the Middle East were urging that it be repudiated." So just 5 years earlier, the Balfour Declaration was backed by the British government, and now, 5 years later, Churchill's colonial secretary, and he's facing a lot of opposition in his own country, by his own government, against that declaration. Less than a month after he's given that appointment as colonial secretary, he travels to Cairo. He travels to the Middle East, and there's this one funny story that I like, not particularly important, but it's just an interesting little tidbit. On March 23rd, 1921, Churchill is visiting the Gaza area, and this is from Manchester's book. "Churchill and his entourage are confronted by a mob of about 150,000 Arabs. The mob was chanting, 'Down with the Jews, cut their throats.' Churchill obviously didn't know what they were saying. They were chanting that in Arabic. And Manchester writes, Churchill, misunderstanding their fervor, thought they were acclaiming him and waved back cheerfully. Lawrence," this is Lawrence of Arabia, his assistant here, "then translated their chants. And Winston muttered that he was at least grateful they weren't stoning him." So a bit of positivity there as these angry chants are going on. Churchill thinks everybody loves him. And then he's just thankful that they're not stoning him. It's around this time that Churchill's getting pretty frustrated with trying to negotiate between the Jews and the Arabs. The Arabs are obviously, and you have to bear this in mind when Britain is trying to organize things out here. The Arabs are good friends of Britain as well, and Britain has a lot of interests, obviously, in the oil fields there, and they don't want to upset the Arabs. But the Arabs were upset with Britain because Britain was taking this pro-Zionist stance, essentially, and they were telling the British, well, we're going to start rejecting you. We're going to start rebelling against your control in this area. And they threatened to turn to Russia or Germany to give them their own state in Palestine. And that is really when Churchill said, "This, we're not dealing with this." And he threw his hands up in the air, and it just made him, you know, even more for the cause of the Jewish state. Churchill reminded the Arabs that it was Britain who liberated the Arabs from the harsh rule of the Turks. He reminded them how many thousands of British soldiers had died in the Middle East to defeat Turkey and to liberate the Arabs. So here are all of these Arab countries saying, well, we're going to rebel against you if you don't give us what we want. And Churchill saying, we gave you what you want. You have this, you have 3, 4, 5 countries, your own states here. And we just want the Jews to be able to emigrate to this little sliver of land. Manchester says after this Arab threat, whatever his previous doubts about the justice of creating a Zionist state, they were gone now. He knew that it would be expensive, but he believed the price must be paid. At the time, however, he urged the Jews to be realistic. So Churchill is saying, I'm backing you. I want you to have your own state, but we have to be realistic. We have to be realistic about the scenario that we're working within. In 1920, the Arabs that lived in Palestine numbered 500,000, and the Jews were 80,000. So setting up a democratic government that involved all the inhabitants of this area was impractical because the Arabs would have had control of it and they would have blocked Jewish immigration. So it was imperative that Britain kept control of it and that they kept their pro-Jewish stance. Now, the Arabs are upset by Churchill. Britain, though, is turning its back on the Balfour Declaration, and Churchill's having to battle that. It was in 1921 that Britain's House of Lords voted against the Balfour Declaration by a vote of 60-29. So now they're backtracking on the Balfour Declaration. And at this time, Churchill is trying to fight to keep that declaration alive. He's having to fight for it in the lower House of Commons, the larger house. Manchester writes, an Arab delegation called at the colonial office. So now the Arabs are complaining to Churchill that they're not getting their way and they're upset with him. Churchill told them bluntly, the British government mean to carry out the Balfour Declaration. I have told you so again and again. I told you so at Jerusalem. I told you so at the House of Commons the other day. And sure enough, Churchill got his way. The House backed him overwhelmingly by a vote of 292-35. So he still has a large amount of support for the Balfour Declaration, but that hostility for it in Britain is brewing. On July 22nd, the League of Nations approved their vote, and Manchester writes, all legal hurdles for the birth of Israel had been cleared. And he goes on, yet it remained in gestation for another quarter century. So in 1921, he's got everything pushed through to create this Jewish state, but then nothing happens for, as Manchester says here, another quarter century. It kind of sits there fluctuating around. Arabs are upset with Jews and protesting going on there and fighting and trying to manage all this. And it's at this time that Churchill is having to deal with Ireland. He's having to face a lot of other setbacks. And especially in his personal life, it's interesting to look at this as he's really pushing this Jewish state through, as he's really bringing the Balfour Declaration to the forefront. His mother dies, who he loved so dearly. So he loses his mom in June of 1921. A few months later, in August of 1921, his two-year-old daughter, Marigold, falls ill, and then she dies just a few days later. So within this two-month span, he loses two individuals very close to him, and that consumes, obviously, a lot of his time as this is happening. And then from that point on, he really focuses his attention on Ireland. But that's not before he writes his own declaration on Palestine. In 1922, Churchill writes his own white paper for Palestine, and a white paper is just a British term, I guess, for their declared stance on an issue. They release it to the people. This is the government's view on something. So Churchill produces his white paper for Palestine in 1922, and Britain pretty much rejected it. They're still holding on to the Balfour Declaration, but that's losing its traction. By 1928, Zionists, with British encouragement, established the Jewish Agency for Palestine to manage their interests there. So now you see a government really starting to take shape, a Jewish government in Palestine taking shape, and that's Britain encouraging them. Probably Churchill sitting there saying, let's start laying the groundwork for you to have a country. So that's 1928. That happens for a few more years. Again, fighting between Arabs and Jews. You have a few more partition plans that are put forward. There's the Peel Commission, and there's a lot of detail that goes into that as well. The main thing is to remember that it didn't go through. One thing to remember, though, is that the Peel Commission did offer the Arabs of Palestine their own state. It offered the Jews their own state, and then it made Jerusalem an international zone. So you have effectively what is a two-state solution, and Churchill was in favor of that. He advised the Jews to take that. You know, whatever you can get, if it's your own country, take it. And it wasn't a lot of space, and it was hard to morph the map around the Arab cities and the Jewish cities. But at any rate, it was a map, and it was offering the Jews their own state. And it was the Arabs that rejected it. There were Jews that also wanted to reject it. They didn't think that it was enough room, and they wanted Jerusalem. They didn't have that sacred area in Jerusalem there. So that gets rejected. Then you get into the 1930s, and this is where it really things start to turn. Obviously, in the early 1930s, you have Hitler in Germany enacting all of these anti-Jew policies. The Jews are persecuted more and more, not just in Germany, but in Eastern Europe as well. And they are fleeing. They're fleeing. They're trying to get to Palestine. But the British they're struggling now because they want to keep the Arabs happy, but the Arabs are unhappy if more Jews come, but it looks very bad because, well, the Jews are fleeing Adolf Hitler. And Churchill, I think at one point says, well, they're both our friends, but one is suffering a lot more than the other. And if the Arabs are really our friends, they're going to be fine with the Jews coming into Palestine because look what they're fleeing. And you really, a lot is revealed in Britain's response to this issue. Martin Gilbert writes in his book, Israel, A History, Sir Horace Rumbold, who took up the questioning, asked Churchill whether there was not harsh injustice to the Arabs if Palestine attracted too many Jews from outside. You know, well, isn't this harmful to the Arabs? Aren't we doing them an injustice by allowing so many Jews in? Churchill replied that even when the Jewish national home became all Palestine, there was no injustice. Why is there harsh injustice done? Churchill asked his questioner. If people come in and make a livelihood for more and make the desert into palm groves and orange groves, why is it injustice? Because there is more work and wealth for everybody. There is no injustice. The injustice is when those who live in the country leave it to be desert for thousands of years. And he's making a very politically incorrect point there, that this land did not have a lot happening for it in the last 2,000 years. And here come the Jews, and they're eager to establish a state. They're building infrastructure. They're being funded by very wealthy people in France and in Britain and America to go over there and build. And it's not for their benefit only, but also for that of the Arabs living there. Clean water, roads, infrastructure. Now, it's at this time that the Jewish immigration of this area is just getting out of hand, and Britain issues another white paper, and the Jews called this a black paper. It limited immigration to 75,000 Jews over a five-year time period. Only 75,000 Jews would be allowed into Palestine, and Jews would not be able to buy land outside of restricted areas. So you see more and more British hostility to Jews moving to Palestine. They're trying to keep the Arabs happy here as well. Gilbert writes in his book, Israel, A History, "Henceforth, at the very moment when Hitler annexed the Czech provinces of Bohemia and Moravia and extended Nazi racial laws to the large Jewish population of Prague, British policy was directed towards stopping Jewish immigrants reaching Palestine in excess of the restrictions. Pressure was put on Romania, Bulgaria, Yugoslavia, and Greece to prevent Jews making their way along the Danube or through the Adriatic and Aegean Seas towards Palestine." Britain saying to these other countries, don't let the Jews go through your land en route to Palestine. Stop them. So as Hitler is chasing the Jews down, and they're running, they're fleeing through the Balkans, they can't get northwest through Germany and France. It's occupied, obviously, by the Nazis, and to go through there is suicidal. So they're having to flee to the southwest through the Balkans, and here is Britain saying, you're going to upset the Arabs if you let them go through there. And this is, and it, the reasoning here is sad, really, when you think about Britain's stance just 20 or 30 years earlier. And then in 1939, the British government issues their white paper. And that is a very memorable point. This is the turning point. Remember 1939 white paper. Now, that white paper limited the Jews from emigrating to Palestine. It said Jews that did make it there would not be allowed to enter and that they would be deported to camps. So at one stage, these ships filled with Jews are coming from the Balkans and the British control the ports of entry into Israel. And they're saying, turn these ships around and send them. You know, in one case, they're sending them to the country or the colony Mauritius. And that's a little island, conglomerate of islands, off the east coast of Madagascar. So take these Jews who have fled from Nazi Germany, made their way to Palestine, and send them another, I guess it's about 4,000 or 5,000 miles, maybe it's less than that, down to these islands in the South Indian Ocean. One officer at the colonial office said the condition of the camps in Mauritius should be sufficiently punitive to continue to act as a deterrent to other Jews in Eastern Europe. Make these camps so bad that Jews won't want to go to Palestine. Churchill was upset, to say the least, by this policy that his country, that his colonial office had adopted. Gilbert writes in Churchill's biography of Churchill, Churchill, A Life, he says, several months earlier, Churchill had refused to implement the decision of the 1939 Palestine White Paper, which envisaged an Arab veto on all Jewish immigration from May 1944. This white paper had greatly aroused his anger at the time. That paper effectively said, the Jews will not have their own state. And now the Jews are panicking over there. David Ben-Gurion, one of the founding fathers of the Jewish state, he says, we will fight with the British against Hitler as if there were no white paper. We will fight the white paper as if there were no war. So now, obviously, the greater enemy here is Adolf Hitler and his mass murder of the Jews, and the Jews are fighting him, and they're fighting alongside Britain to defeat him. But then at the same time, you have Britain putting these huge restrictions on the Jews in Palestine, and they're fighting against that. There's all these diplomatic entanglements happening at the same time. And this is the point where you see Israel turn to terrorism. And you have to bear this in mind because people will bring this up and say, well, the state was founded on terrorism. This was not state-sponsored terrorism. Churchill did not endorse this terrorism, neither did any of the leading Jews. They were actually very upset that these radical extremist Jews were doing what they were doing because it made negotiating a lot harder. But at this time, being British in Palestine was not a fun assignment to get. You're having to deal with Arab terrorism. You're having now to deal with Jewish terrorism against the British. And all the while this is going on, Churchill wants to arm the Jews. He wants to use them to help fight the British, the British fight Germany and Italy's allies in the Middle East. This is from Gilbert's book, Israel, a History, and he's quoting Churchill again. It was an extraordinary position that at a time when the war was probably entering its most dangerous phase, we should station in Palestine a garrison one quarter of the size of our garrison in India, and this for the purpose of forcing through a policy which, in his judgment, was unpopular in Palestine and in Great Britain alike. And he's talking about Lord Halifax there, but he's making the point that, look, the Jews are for us. They're fighting Germany, and they're fighting Hitler. Let's arm them and use them rather than devoting all of our own troops there. We have a fighting force a quarter of the size of our force maintaining our colony in India. And India is hundreds of millions of people, whereas Palestine is just not even half a million, maybe. All of these British leaders are afraid of stirring up the Arabs. And a lot of the supervisors there, the British supervisors there in Palestine said, well, don't bring the Jews here because we don't want there to be protests. We don't want there to be riots on our watch because, well, the blame falls on them. So these extremist groups, these extremist Jews turn to terrorism. And the main group to remember there when studying this is called the Stern Gang or Irgun and Israel. Now, Churchill, he was very upset with what these terrorists were doing. And he never, let that, though, dissuade him from his resolve to seek a Jewish state. Gilbert continues in his book. This is his, I've got three or four of Gilbert's books here. This is the one, Israel, a History. He says, in the late summer of 1943, there was a change in British policy. At Churchill's urging, which enabled several thousand Jews to enter Palestine from Nazi-dominated Europe, any refugee who could get by rail or sea out of the Balkans to Istanbul could proceed to Palestine, irrespective of existing quotas. So Churchill, by this time, says, we need to scrap this quota plan. Let the Jews go. And Britain let them go. So you have this big influx now of Jews coming into Palestine. And it's after the war is going on over there in the Middle East. The German threat is eventually removed from that area. And after they're removed, Britain's not fighting Germany there anymore. They're really looking at the Jews now, these Jewish terrorists, as their enemies. Paul Johnson, in his book, History of the Jews, says British headquarters in Palestine looked with suspicion on any Jewish military activity. They didn't want to arm the Jews, but the Jews had one powerful defender, Churchill. Churchill wanted to arm the Jews. He was confident that they could keep those weapons out of the hands of those terrorists and that they could fight or carry out Britain's will in the region. Now, Churchill had tried this before, but the British army kept putting blocks in the way and kept preventing this from happening. Churchill said, I like the idea of the Jews trying to get at the murderers of their fellow countrymen in Central Europe. It is with the Germans that they have their quarrel. I cannot conceive why this martyred race, scattered about the world and suffering as no other race has done at this juncture, should be denied the satisfaction of having a flag. Gilbert says on September 28, 1944, Churchill announced in the House of Commons that the Jewish Brigade Group would be set up to be trained and armed by Britain as the frontline military unit. So here is Churchill, and he is encouraging the Jews, the armament of the Jews. And again, this is another pivotal step to the creation of the Jewish state. They now are getting their own army in order. That fighting force was about 25,000 men strong. The Arabs understandably were upset. They looked to Germany to form its own Arab army there. They never got it. But by the end of the war in 1945, more than 30,000 Palestinian Jews ended up serving in the British Army. And Churchill recognized it. He said, "The Jews are not our enemy. They want to help us defeat Hitler." Now, by 1945, here's the state of the Middle East. By May, Germany has surrendered. The Arabs have quite a few countries here in the Middle East. Just some statistics here. They have Syria, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and Transjordan. And the combined population of those areas was 14 million people, and it covered 1,184,000 square miles, well over four times the size of the state of Texas. And that area is filled with oil. In Palestine, this little area, the west coast of the Mediterranean to the Jordan River, down to the Sinai Peninsula, to the Golan Heights, this tiny little sliver of land, 10,500 square miles, about the size of the U.S. state of Maryland. There were 1,140,000 Arabs and 517,000 Jews. So a big population explosion, not just with the Jews, but with the Arabs as well. And that's important to keep in mind. The Arabs were not being forced from this land. And the war is over, and the Jews are hopeful that this means Britain will lift up on the immigration quota, that all of the Jews that are fleeing Europe will be able to come to Palestine freely. But as we learn, that is not the case. Gilbert writes in his book, Israel, A History, I think, yeah, that's his. "But whereas Churchill was sympathetic to the idea of Jewish statehood, this was true neither of the Conservative Party, which he led, nor, in fact, of the Labor Party, which was hoping to come to power, even though it explicitly supported Jewish statehood at its party conference in the autumn of 1944. So Labor, they're pro-Zionist, or so they say. The Conservatives are the ones that are against it. And Churchill now is alone. Labor is not going to stand up for a Jewish state. The Conservative Party is definitely not going to stand up for it. And it's Churchill. It's Winston Churchill standing there in 1945 saying, am I the only one that wants this? And it's unfortunate that just 2 months after Germany surrendered, Britain held elections on July 5th. Churchill lost. He was out of power. And Britain's or the Jewish hope that Britain would help them establish a homeland was pretty much gone. Churchill told the Jews that if they were still interested in forming a nation, they would have to look to America. David Ben-Gurion is upset with Britain for maintaining those immigration quotas. He wrote, "If the British government really intends now to maintain and enforce the white paper, it will have to use constant and brutal force to do so." And that's where you get more of that extreme, those extremist Jews committing acts of terror. And then about this time where you see the next 2 or 3 years, Britain really just pulls back. They pull out. They don't want anything to do with this region. And it's about 1947, 1948 that they pull out altogether. They hand over Palestine to the United Nations to be handled there. And another thing to keep in mind here is at this time, no government in Britain or America was really for creating a Jewish state. There wasn't financial benefit to it, really. And you risk upsetting the Arabs, where you have a lot of oil coming from. Now, again, another miracle, and it just so works out this way that as Churchill moves out of that position, you get in the United States a man sympathetic to the Jewish cause, Harry Truman. Johnson writes in his book, History of the Jews, "It is impossible to point to any powerful economic interest in either Britain or the United States, which pushed for the creation of Israel. In both countries, the overwhelming majority of her friends were on the left." You know, they weren't in power. They were gone. And now you get Truman in office. And it so happens that Truman is very sympathetic. And Johnson notes that had it been Roosevelt, had Roosevelt not died, he probably would not have been for this nearly to the degree that Truman was. So it so happens Churchill is voted out of office and Truman is now in office in America. And you have this shift of power from Britain being the foremost power to creating the Jewish state, now transferred over to the United States. On May 14, 1948, Israel declares independence. Truman recognizes the Jewish state immediately. I think it was something like 10 or 11 minutes after they declared it. And then 3 or 4 hours later, Israel is at war. I think the Truman bit is very interesting because he was doing this against the advice of his own Secretary of State. His Secretary of State was telling him, do not recognize them. This will upset the neighboring Arab nations. And Truman just did it. What's happening here that you have one man in the British government, Winston Churchill, that's so pro-Jewish state, pro-Zionist. He's voted out. And then it so happens that in America, you get this man who is also pro-Zionist. Paul Johnson says, timing was absolutely crucial to Israel's birth and survival. So they fall within this crack, this moment of time where the United Nations is responsible now for Palestine. You have Britain is obviously out of the picture here. You have Russia, who plays a huge role in the United Nations, and they have this brief moment in Russia where Joseph Stalin is pro-Zionist. The Russians are pro-Zionist because he thinks that he can create a Jewish state that is a communist state. So just a few years after the war, you have this window of time where Russia is for the creation of a Jewish state. And then just 3 or 4 months after Israel declares itself a state, Russia flips totally, and they become wholly anti-Zionist. Johnson writes in his book, if the British evacuation had been postponed another year, the United States would have been far less anxious to see Israel created, and Russia would almost certainly be hostile. Hence, the effect of the terror campaign on British policy was perhaps decisive to the entire enterprise. Israel slipped into existence through a fortuitous window in history, which briefly opened for a few months in 1947 and 1948. That, too, was luck or providence. So this whole time, there's no money to be made in Israel. There's no oil. And Churchill, from a young age, wants to see the creation of this Jewish state. And then you have this transition to the United States, who happens to have a man in charge who also wants to see that happen as well. In 1952, and now Churchill doesn't have as influential a role in Britain's government. I think he's still a member of parliament at this time. He says, from the days of the Balfour Declaration, this is in 1952, sorry, he's speaking to the United States Congress, Churchill is. He says, from the days of the Balfour Declaration, I have desired that the Jews should have a national home, and I have worked for that end. I rejoice to pay my tribute here to the achievements of those who have founded the Israelite state, who have defended themselves with tenacity, and who offer asylum to great numbers of Jewish refugees. I hope that with their aid, they may convert deserts into gardens. But if they are to enjoy peace and prosperity, they must strive to renew and preserve their friendly relations with the Arab world, without which widespread misery might follow for all. And if you haven't, I'd encourage you to listen to Mr. Stephen Fleury's program on Anwar Sadat, and he talks about that Arab peace with Israel, that brief moment in the 70s and 80s. But look at Churchill's language here. With their aid, they may convert deserts into gardens. That is vision. That's vision for what this land can become. In 1954, Churchill suggests that Israel become a part of the British Commonwealth. In 1956, there's a lot of tension now happening between Egypt and Israel, the Suez Crisis. Churchill wrote to the United States President Eisenhower, he says, "I am, of course, a Zionist, and have been ever since the Balfour Declaration. I think it is a wonderful thing that this tiny colony of Jews should have become a refuge to their compatriots in all the lands where they were persecuted so cruelly, and at the same time establish themselves as the most effective fighting force in the area." Now, I'm quickly running out of time here, but this is just fascinating history to study in light of prophecy. It's fascinating just to be informed by this context when you read the news today. Now, these men, it's so controversial today, but it really shouldn't be. It really should be obvious what Churchill was doing here. It should be obvious that Israel is a force for good in that area. Think about the events that took place for this to happen. Churchill's resolve to see the formation of a Jewish state. President Truman taking office in the United States right after Churchill is voted out. And then Israel, you know, falling right into the middle of all of this and ending up with a nation. And we know that the Jews would have their own nation. There are numerous, numerous prophecies that in order to be fulfilled and require the Jews to have their own state, their own nation. And there's such an abundant amount of detail about what would happen here. It's so incredible to study this history with these prophecies in mind. You know, think about Ezekiel 33 and Winston Churchill in prophecy. Think about him being the watchman and the foresight that he had. Now, he was proud of his heritage. He knew that Western civilization and that heritage was rooted in the Bible. And think about these things happening at the same time. These events, Churchill, the watchman on the scene, standing up against all, you know, in the face of so much opposition, and then this Jewish state of Israel being formed at the same time. It's incredible history to study. And we have quite a few articles that talk about it as well. My time is just about up. I missed the promo. I just kept going. So I apologize there if you were really getting thirsty there and needed a break. But if you want to learn more about this, I would encourage you to go on the Trumpet website and read Mr. Stephen Fleury's reprint article, Band of Brothers. And then as well, read Mr. Ron Fraser's reprint article, Israel from Hero to Outcast. Be informed by the prophecy here. It's such an exciting period in the 20th century history and prophecy there as well. That is all I have time for. Thank you for listening today. I think Mr. Fleury will be back on Monday. He's planning to record a few more programs, I believe, from Jerusalem. So thank you for listening. And as Mr. Fleury says, go ahead and send any comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for listening.